It was a blustery and frigid January morning in the year 2007 when an unassuming man made his way to the Federal Triangle Station in Washington, D.C. He took a position in the bustling lobby with streams of rush hour people rapidly moving by. And he did something that wasn't too uncommon at that time. He retrieved a violin from the worn case he was carrying and adeptly tuned the strings. Once satisfied that the tones would be absolutely perfect and that the hair on the bow was adjusted properly, he lifted the instrument to his chin and began to play. The notes, oh, the notes he created. They mingled with the shuffling shoes, the clanking coins, the clattering of turnstiles, and the distant rumble of the trains. For 45 minutes, he filled the enclosure with intricate trills and the metered melodies of Johann Sebastian Bach, never once missing a note. His inflections and emotional renderings were flawless. Now, while the musician played, one middle-aged man stopped for a brief moment and then moved on. A few minutes later, a woman passed and tossed a dollar bill into the open case as she also hurried by. And a few minutes later, several children heading to school paused quizzically and then were dragged away by their preoccupied parents. And after 45 minutes of playing beautiful music, he counted his earnings for the morning, and he found $32 in his case, placed by approximately 20 people, none of whom actually stopped to listen. As a matter of fact, no one save the middle-aged man had even taken the time to enjoy the music as it ricocheted throughout the station. No one applauded or even showed more than a passing interest in the music. What they did not know or even try to discover was that the man in the lobby was Joshua Bell, one of the world's, if not the world's, greatest violinist. The instrument he was playing was valued at more than $3.5 million. And just 2 days before, Joshua, this musician, had played the exact music before a packed concert hall where tickets averaged $100 each. Well, this is a true story, and it gives us some evidence that at such a time and place, several thousand people passing by failed to recognize one of the most talented individuals of a generation playing some of the finest music ever written on one of the most exquisite instruments. They simply did not stop to listen. What a loss. They had preconceived notions about the circumstances. And these preconceived notions might have been based on the looks. It might have been based on the culture. It might have been on the location, because everyone knows how busy those metro stations are. But today, as we worship, do we have preconceived notions about people? Do we have preconceived notions about spiritual matters? do we even have preconceived notions about the God we're coming here to worship? Our culture, our friends, books, the television, internet, now even Facebook, shape our thoughts. And we often, unfortunately, develop these preconceived notions, which makes it very hard to see the way things actually are. Sometimes truth is obscured, and these people that morning did not recognize the music. They didn't recognize the musician. They didn't recognize the music. And as we worship at this time, March 16, 2013, a time that all of us share together, a time in our lives that we will never get back again, do we have preconceived notions and thoughts limiting our own ability to see truth? And my next question, as you sit here this morning, are we willing to take the time to listen? Are we too busy to listen? Are we too busy with our preconceived lives? Are we too busy expecting things to go a certain way? Are we willing to take time to listen? Or are these preconceived notions going to get in our way this morning? Do we have preconceived notions about sermons, about church, about life, about what should be said, about what a denomination should do? I hope not. And as we open our minds together, I want to once again invite the Holy Spirit to touch our lives. Shall we all bow our heads one more time? Father God, we want to listen. We want and desire to hear your voice. Please take away these preconceived emotions as we learn. As we learn about you creating a new heart in us, is our humble prayer. Amen. In my personal and professional life, I realize I've had a lot of preconceived notions. Preconceived notions about spiritual things, and also preconceived notions about medicine, about the way I was trained. And Pastor Arnold said some of the places I went, and you think, you know, after 4 years here, 3 years there, 4 years here, practicing here and there, you would think you would learn some things. But I found out that I've learned more once I got out of school than I did in school. And I realized that they were filling me with a lot of preconceived notions about things, and some of these things were not even right. And that bothered me and it plagued me that I spent all that time, all that effort, and all the things that I learned and hours that I spent, there was all these preconceived notions. You know, they taught me that if someone had high blood pressure, I had to give them a high blood pressure medicine. If someone was overweight and had diabetes, I had to give them a blood sugar medicine. If someone had a pain in the leg, I had to give them a non-steroidal or a pain medicine. If someone couldn't sleep at night, I had to give them a sleeping pill. If someone had anxiety, I had to give them an anxiety pill. If someone had depression, I had to give them a depression med. And the list went on and on. Well, I realized that something was just not right. It made no sense to me after I practiced for a while, and I saw the rates of heart disease continue to go up. People still had heart attacks. The rate of cancer still increased. The rate of chronic disease, diabetes, strokes, high blood pressure, depression, all of them continue to go up. I realized that something was not right. All these preconceived notions, all the listening that I did just wasn't paying off. I started to search in a new pathway. And I remember at the University of Texas, if any of you have been there, there's a tower that sits in the middle of that tower there, and it says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." That always stuck with you. And at that time of my life, a young pastor was also a single young pastor, had just got out of seminary, and he was spending some time with me, and our paths just happened to cross. His name was Randy Roberts. And I can remember spending afternoons with Randy talking about truth, learning about what it would take to find out what truth really was. Subsequently, Randy has moved on. He got married, and now he has a church out in California. We were able to talk recently. But I realized that truth was somewhere else, and that you shall know the truth, and truth shall set you free. And I can remember a conversation I had with him a long time ago that the truth really is in the Bible. And I begin to wonder whether the Bible might not be the best medical textbook I've had. And as I've been privileged to come and worship here over the last 11, 12 years and learn new things, I saw God changing me, opening up new eyes. And I realized that the best textbook I had was right here. This was the best medical textbook, and yet I was never taught about in medical school, in residency, in fellowship. I was never taught that this was the best medical textbook. And I began to look for truth in the Bible. And I went back to the Bible, and I would find text in the Bible and then trying to prove the chemistry scientifically. For instance, well, the Bible says if we have a day of rest, our chemistry's better. Well, I went back and proved it scientifically. And now I introduce this to people that want to have treatment for heart disease. Back at creation was the template when everything was perfect. So I used creation as my guideline. I soon learned that a lot of the disease we have is because of stress on a system. Some people say, well, I have bad genetics, and that's true. Many people have bad genetics, but that was still stress on a system that's been passed down generation after generation after generation. Stress coming from all sorts of different avenues where we vary from the template that was given to us at creation. We were designed to have water. 70% of Americans are dehydrated. They don't drink enough water. We know when you don't drink enough water, stress comes on. We were designed to rest, both a weekly rest and at night, and now we can prove that when we don't do that, stress is put on the body. We were also designed to love each other. When we don't love each other, stress is put on the body. When we have selfishness in a life, stress is putting on the body. We were designed to be outside. When we're not outside, stress is put on the body. And we can prove that chemically via serotonin or whatever chemical that doesn't happen when we don't get outside. So this Bible taught me about where disease was coming from. Stress on a system because we varied from the original plan. So I began to search for new things that I could add for my patients. And I termed this biblical technology. Chemistry changes when we find things in the Bible that changes our own chemistry. And I admit, there is a place for modern medicine. If someone's having a heart attack, believe me, I want to have a stent in them right away. If a person's heart's going too slow, I want a pacemaker. If someone needs bypass, I want those bypasses getting extra blood around the heart. But also, I want to ask, well, why did we need that in the very first place? Why did we need that? Why was putting stress on the system? Was it genetics? Was it something we were doing? Or bigger yet, was it something we were thinking? As a cardiologist, I'm very fascinated by this word heart. Very fascinated by the word heart. And I realized in studying the Word of God, heart came up many times. And I also realized that there's a place for modern medicine. There's a place for changing a lifestyle. But really, that wasn't where healing was at. Where healing was really at was in that relationship with God. That's where healing really occurred. And I think by the time we're finished, we're going to understand what I mean by that even fuller. That relationship changed our chemistry, changes a lot of things about us. Then I began to see things a little bit differently when I came to church. I started saying, this is treatment. more than just spiritual matters. This is treatment physically as well. So I wanted to have a relationship built into the practice of medicine with the ultimate physician. Now, how many here, I asked this in the first two services, how many here have gone to a doctor's office before? Okay, let me put it this way. Who has not ever gone to a doctor's office? Okay, no hands went up. So I think you can relate to this. Imagine yourself going to a doctor's office, and you walk in the lobby, and you go up to the receptionist, and she says, "Wow, I'm so glad to see you. I'm glad you're here. You don't have to sign in. No, you don't. We're expecting you. Forms? Hey, you don't have to fill out any forms. Copay? Forget a copay. Forget it. We're glad you're here." And everyone else, no one's in the lobby thinking, "Well, I wonder what's wrong with that guy. I wonder why he's coming to the doctor's office today." You have none of that. And you're starting to feel pretty good. "Hey, I really like this office here. I think I'm going to want to come here again." And can you imagine going back into the exam room, and when you get to the exam room, you don't have to put on one of those flimsy gowns, you know, where half of you is hanging out the back and you're sort of embarrassed. You don't have to do that. They don't even check your blood pressure or stick you with the needle. None of that goes on. The nurse there is just welcoming you. "I'm glad you're here. The doctor is going to be in just a second. No wait. He's going to be right there for you." And guess what? You don't have to look at a magazine. Boom. The door opens up. The doctor comes down. He sits right down in the seats. And he says, "How can I serve you?" Wow. Then you can start going on and on and on. And guess what? The doctor never once interrupts. Never interrupts. He doesn't have his hand on the door. He's not busy taking notes or logging things now into a computer. He's not reaching for his prescription pad. None of that's going on. He doesn't ever interrupt you. He doesn't ever look like he's in a hurry. And you go on and on and talk about all the things in your life that need healing, all the problems you have, and how things aren't going very well. And when you're done, he asks you, "Are you finished now?" And you said, "Well, yeah, I think so. I'm pretty much done." And then he says, "Well, listen, Jim, this is what you need." And he gives you this prescription that you can take out. And there's not necessarily a medicine, but he gives you some things that you can do to help your life be better, to deal with some of these problems you have. And you go out, and unfortunately, your memory's not too good, and you forget everything that happened. And you fall back into the old ruts and get sick again and start having these symptoms and all this stress come on you again. And you get sick again. You get so sick and so ill that you have to go back to the doctor the next day. Oh, and you're a little embarrassed. You know, "I was just there yesterday. They were so nice to me." So you walk in the front door again and they say, "Hey, you're back again. We're glad to see you." And you're expecting, you know, the copay, you're expecting the forms, you're expecting something. No, you don't get any of that. And everyone else looks like they're glad to see you too. And he says, "You can go right back and talk to the doctor again." And you go in and sit down with the doctor, and he sits there with you, and he looks you straight in the eye, and he says, "Hey, I saw you yesterday. I am really glad you came back to see me today. What's going on?" And then he comes up to you. He comes up to you and gives you a real good bear hug. A real good hug. Not a fake hug. Not one of these flimsy handshakes. A real good hug. And you know that he's really glad to see you. And then you tell him, "Listen, I messed up bad yesterday. I didn't do anything you told me to do. I even forgot most of it. And look, I'm back in the same position today that I was in yesterday." And that physician goes through it all again with you, and he says, "You know, Jim, if you have problems during this day, guess what? I want you to come back and see me tomorrow, and we'll go over it again. Maybe you should just pick one thing out of the list. Maybe you're trying to do too much. Maybe we need to go a little slower, but I'll be here for you tomorrow." Well, in my search for truth, I realize that this ultimate physician was part of the healing equation. But it's nice to hear it, but we needed proof. You know, we have proof that the diets work. We have proof that, you know, rest works and water works and being outside works. But we needed proof that this method, this ultimate physician, could actually change our chemistry. This relationship that I was knew was true because the ultimate source of truth was telling them it was a true. So as a cardiologist, I was very fascinated by the word heart. I wanted to somehow plug in heart and figure out how the heart would work. And I came to this in Psalms 51, verse 10. This is David here in the Psalms. And David's words, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me." What does this create? He knew that we couldn't do it ourselves. He had to create in something new. We had to ask. This was a gift. There's nothing we could do. David couldn't make his own heart. He couldn't have someone else. He says, "God, create me a clean heart." Well, what about this word heart? What did David mean when he said heart? And remember, this was at the time that David's word, this was after Nathan went to him after the incident with Bathsheba, and it prompted this request. And I think this was more than a request. I think this was a pleading. I think this was a yearning. I think he was coming back to the office saying, "I messed up. Help me. I need more. I feel bad." But was this heart, was this clean heart, was he talking about a stent or an angioplasty or a bypass or some medicines? Or perhaps was he even talking about a transplantation? Well, I didn't really understand this heart thing. So I said, well, you know, who in the Bible is the smartest? Solomon, right? Pastor Jerry, how many sermons have we had on Ecclesiastes? Well, there's a reason for that, because Solomon's smart. So he had some smart things to say. I said, well, you know, I'm going to go back to Solomon and see what this clean heart's about. So I looked in Proverbs 23:7. "For as he thinks in his heart, so he is." Well, that helps me out. The heart is the place where thinking occurs. So he is. This is what Solomon, the wisest person at that time, thought. That the heart was a center of thinking, the center of reasoning. This is where it's at. It's in the heart. I'm excited as a cardiologist. Thinking in the heart, I like that. You know, the neurologists and other professions that I'm dealing with, no. This is where it's at. It's in the heart. I'm on the right thing because I've already studied the heart for a few years. We're going to have some answers here. But as I realized, I said, listen, I need some consults on this heart. You know, sometimes you need to get some advice of other physicians. So I went to this doctor here. This is Dr. Hippocrates, and he was a Greek physician. And many of you might know some of the things he says, and some of the things he said was just wonderful and universal that we're still using today. He said that, first, do no. Yeah, everyone's heard that before. First, do no harm. Don't hurt somebody. Well, are we in medicine hurting somebody? Better than that, are we in church hurting people? First, do no harm. He also taught that the body was made to heal itself. The body was made to heal itself. But one thing he taught for quite a few years was that the heart was the center of reasoning. And if you look at the dates, David lived about 1000 B.C. Hippocrates came along about 460 B.C. Later on, a physician named Herophilus, about 300 B.C., he was allowed to actually dissect people, to cut them open and looking at the parts. He was from the Alexandrian school, which unfortunately all the medical records were burnt down. But at this time, Herophilus was teaching that, no, these guys might not be right. Solomon might be wrong. Hippocrates might be wrong. The center of reasoning is not the heart. The center of reasoning is the brain. Well, can you imagine? This threw the whole medical profession of the time into a tizzy. You know, hey, listen, Solomon said it's the heart. Everyone says it's the heart. This is where we think, right here in the heart. There's something going on here. You are crazy, Herophilus. We don't like you anymore. Go away. You can't practice medicine here anymore. 200 years ago, if you didn't put leeches on a patient, you were considered a bad doctor. In the 1930s, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they treated, for the treatment of asthma, they used cigarettes. And if you weren't doing that, putting leeches and having people smoke, you were considered a bad doctor, a bad healer. Well, guess what? Poor old Herophilus, he was considered a bad doctor, a bad healer. Now I'm looking back over time, and I'm wondering what history will say about this time in our lives in medicine. What is history going to look back and say about this time? Not only in medicine and healing, but we're going to find out that the spiritual healing is also intimately involved. And what is history going to look back 100 years and see about the way people were worshiping? What are they going to say? Were people getting better and living longer and not dying? If we're doing something right, shouldn't everyone be getting better? Shouldn't more people be coming to worship? Shouldn't more people be coming to our church if we're doing this right? Or is it maybe a little bit like medicine? You know, the disease is going up. Let's just treat the symptoms. Let's not get at the cause. Well, this opened up a new door for me when I realized it's the brain. I'm at the wrong organ. So do I have to go back to a fellowship in brain and chemistry and psychiatry? Oh man, I'm already pretty old. You know, I'm married, got some kids. I think I better start to work. But maybe I can learn this on my own with the help from God. So that's what I did. I said, let's go back to some more scriptures. And let's substitute the word heart, brain, in for heart or mind in. John 14, 1. Let not your heart, let not your brain be troubled. Well, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people have troubled or stressed brains. 1 Samuel 16, 7. There's over 700 of these heart type illustrations in the Bible. It must have something important to do if God mentioned it so many times. For the Lord does not see as a man sees, for a man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart, the brain, the mind. Well, how many of us are able to do this? None of us are able to do this. And how many of us go around thinking that we can judge somebody where it says that only God can look at the mind, only God knows our hearts? Psalms 45:1, my heart, my mind is overflowing with a good thing, the yearning of your heart, your mind. In Jeremiah, then I will give them a heart to know me. Then I will give them a mind to know me. Is this something you can do? Is this something you can earn? It's a gift. Create me. You have to ask for it. I will give them this mind. Ezekiel 36, 26. I will give you a new heart and a new spirit. So evidently there is something inherently wrong with the brain, with the mind that we have brought forward with us to this point in time. Now Daniel 1:20, I've used that a lot of years in supporting eating a healthy diet, especially moving towards lots of fruits, vegetables, and nuts and grains. And I've used this story many times. But now that I became to start understanding that this heart and brain thing had something very important, I went back to this story. And if you remember the story, Daniel and his friends were traumatically taken out of their homelands at a fairly young age. There was no mom and dad telling them what to do, but mom and dad left truth in their heart that they could take with them forever. So they were still able to do something with this. They were in that new land, and these boys were able to stand up to the king, to stand up to the big cheese, so to speak, to stand up to the president, to stand up to whoever's in charge and say, listen, we don't want to do this. We really don't want to do this. We really don't want to eat this food you have. We want to have pulse and water. Remember the story? But this story was more than about food. It was more than about pulse and water, as we're going to see later. In Daniel 1:20, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better after a short period of time. 10 times. So let's assume that the Babylonian guys were no slouches and had IQs of 120, 130. Okay? Well, just think, Daniel's fellas had IQs 10 times that. So we're talking about brains, IQs of 1,200. Wow, I want to understand this more in biblical technology. Maybe there's something here that we can help change people's brains a little bit. And it's more than food, as we're going to find out. 10 times better when they did this. But we're going to find out it's something so much more. When I was at the University of Texas, I had a doctor that I didn't care for too much. His name was Dr. Singer, and he was a short fellow with a beard, and he was teaching me developmental biology, how things developed. And this is a very complicated field that we're going to move in here now, but this is the brain, and I'm going to try to make it as simple as I can right now. One of the assignments I was given one summer was to follow a little butterfly around where the butterfly lived. And we were supposed to learn about butterflies. And in developmental biology, he was trying to illustrate this concept called the motivational triad. What motivates us? What motivates it on an animal level? And this goes for butterflies, and it goes for lizards and reptiles and snakes. And to some degree, it goes with humans, as we're going to find out. Well, the first thing the butterfly likes to do is to seek pleasure. Okay? Well, you ask yourself, well, how does a butterfly seek pleasure? You know, what's a butterfly do? Well, butterflies, the way they seek pleasure is they want to get food, and another way is they want to reproduce. You know, snakes do that. Sharks do that. That's the way they seek pleasure. They're not able to listen to radio programs or go out and talk to friends or hear jokes and other ways of pleasure. That's how they have pleasure. Another thing is that the butterflies like to do that was very important, and you can imagine how boring this is to sit there all day with a butterfly with a speck on his back following him around a little circle. And in retrospect, it's helped me, but at the time, it was not helping me very much. And I had to write down, at 2 p.m., butterfly goes to plant in an area. At 2:15, butterfly finds food and eats food. At 3 o'clock, here's the second part of the motivational triad, the butterfly seeks to avoid pain. So part of this behavior, avoiding pain, If one of the butterfly's enemies came that would mess with him, you know, he had some insects that would get on him, or if you had cold weather, butterfly would go somewhere else. So butterflies seek to avoid pain. We see that in the animals. So this was some of our old behavior. And I like to think this is the hard drive that our brain was sort of based on. And unfortunately or fortunately, we have some of these tendencies ourselves. You know, we seek pleasure, and some of us like pleasure in food. We try to avoid pain. That's something that we've kept with it. And the last thing the butterfly would do is conserve energy. And I noticed that the butterfly had 2 stacks of food, 1 stack that was here and 1 stack over there. If he was hungry, he would go to the stack of food that was closest to him. That's what he would do. He wants to conserve energy. If butterfly was happy, he had enough pleasure, there was no pain, butterfly wouldn't just go around and do things. He wouldn't go help, you know, other insects or other butterflies. He wasn't designed to help the world or anything like that. Butterfly would just sit on his twig and just sit there. He wouldn't do anything if he didn't have to. So butterfly was conserving his energy. Well, Dr. Singer, you know, after we turned in the reports and I said, this is, you know, butterfly did all the things you said. And he says, would you like to go out and do this with fish now? And I go, no. I think I've learned my lesson here. Okay. And the reason I bring this up is we share some of these properties in this old brain. And this older, primitive part of our brain is right in this area here. This is called the limbic system, okay? And this part here is called the prefrontal cortex. Our eyes are up here. This part here that we're going to talk a lot about in the amygdala, we're going to talk a lot about that. And I'm going to try to make this very, very, very simple as we move on. But we need to understand a little bit about driving behavior, this hard drive in us, because up in here we're going to see this is the programming part. This is sort of the soft drive, the parts that we can change and we can have work with. And I'm going to give an example of how these connections, the connections are formed after I tell you a little bit about the brain. Did you know that the brain has billions and billions of cells, and these cells are called neurons? And there's trillions of supporting cells that connect these called axons and dendrites. And if you look at all the connections in the brain, there's estimated to be a quadrillion connections. So someone once asked me, would you rather have a brain or a computer? And I said, well, you know, I would rather have a brain. Now, it's sort of amazing, you know, when we have computers, these computers, everything that happens in a computer can be tracked to somewhere. Well, you know, it's no wonder that God knows our brains. He can track everything that's going on in our brain. He knows everything that's gone in our brain, everything that will go on our brain. He can predict what's going on in our brain, but it's so great that we have a chance to choose what goes on in our brain. Well, this is the brain, and I'm going to just talk about a few of the connections, and just to realize how strong these connections that we develop over a lifetime. And I need your help with this. I want you to fill in the blank. This is sort of going to be like a lesson here. If I say 2, 4, 6, oh, great. You guys, now that was a neural connection that's happening there. This one might be a little bit different. Some of the younger people might not be able to get this one. Jerry will get this one. I'd like to teach the world to... Yeah. You know, some of the younger people haven't heard that one. Here's another one. It might date ourselves. Good to the last. Yeah. For God so loved thee. Man, you're doing great at this. These are all neural connections involving billions of cells and synapses and neurons that's going on in the front part of the brain. Unfortunately, my butterfly could not do that kind of stuff. You know, my butterfly was wired a little bit different than we're wired. So, in this system here, this is the limbic system. This is the part that does emotion, feelings, anxiety, fear. When you're scared to death of something, this part is turned on. When you have guilt, that part is turned on. When you have problems and stress, this part is turned on, especially this part called the amygdala. The amygdala is the alarm system of the brain, and it does great if you have to get out of the way of a big truck that's bearing down on you. But if this is turned on, stress, day in, day out, year in and year out, all these bad chemicals are made, and you might have heard some names of them. Chemicals like adrenaline, which speeds up the heart, constricts blood vessels, knocks down your immune system, makes you clot more, even can cause heart attacks if the level's high enough. It makes another chemical called cortisol, which raises your blood sugar, because in an emergency, you need blood sugar to fight. But long term, you don't need it. It makes a bunch of inflammatory mediators that stimulates the immune system. The cells called the interleukins and the cytokines, they get revved up when a body's under stress. So this amygdala is very important, especially as we think about our definition of stress not being good. So you can say, well, anything that goes against the way God made me could create this stress pathway. And this stress pathway could cause long enough symptoms. And I might go to a doctor or healer and get medications, but I might not deal with the original problem. So this is the part of the brain we have to turn off. Butterfly knew how to turn it off. If he had pain, he'd turn around and go the other way. If we have pain, how do we turn around and go the other way? The prefrontal cortex is where we actively think about things. The amygdala, a very important part that butterflies do not have. Humans have this, and also some primates. Well, the amygdala, This is the part of the brain that helps us with empathy, love, caring for each other. If this part of the brain is not developed very well, and someone punches you in the face, you might punch them right back. This is the part of the brain that helps us love our enemies. This is the part of the brain that when someone criticizes you or gives you a hard time and you know you're right, this is the part of the brain that helps it not hurt us so much. This is called the anterior cingulate. And I wanted to introduce you to some of these parts. So our goal for heading down the stress chemistry is to turn off this part of the brain as much as we can, except in emergencies, and turn on the amygdala, which helps us the prefrontal cortex. And this brings me to how we study this. And we can study the brain now in very great detail. This is called a PET scan, and it stands for positron emission tomography. We can actually study the brain and see it growing. We can see which part of the brains are working with different types of activities. And the work in this field has been very interesting, especially by a physician that I want to give credit to. This is not my research that I'm going to be introducing. This is Dr. Andrew Newberg's research out of the University of Pennsylvania. And he has done a lot of studies with brains and PET scans, seeing which part of the brain are involved in different things. And one of the things Dr. Andrew Newberg did is he studied the anterior cingulate. And he found out that people that worshiped 12 minutes a day, just 12 minutes a day, for 2 months, all of a sudden this anterior cingulate got busy. It started lighting up. It actually developed new neurons. The brain grew more cells. It also impacted the part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex. And it sent out new chemicals called neurotrophic factors, which develop new connections within our brain. It also, the people that worship started thinking a little bit differently based on tests. He also noticed that when this part of the brain through worship got bigger, this bad part of the brain, the one that created stress, started getting smaller. Just worship 12 minutes a day for 2 months, and the brain began to change, the neurons, the neuroplasticity begins to change. But not only that, the chemicals within the brain that the brain made begin to change as well. Chemicals like endorphins, the feel-good chemicals, started to go up when people started to worship. Chemicals like dopamine started to go up when people worship. And likewise, these chemistry, these bad chemistries, this inflammation, these negative chemistry, adrenaline, cortisol, started going down. Well, he says, well, this is great. And he started to study people with diseases that we commonly see now. Alzheimer's disease. People that were having problems lose weight. Cortisol level go down. That's a good thing. He found out that we could change our physiology by this process called worship. But he also found out, and this is very important, that people that in their worship had fear, anxiety, or guilt, or stress, or problems, the worship at that time was ineffective. The anterior cingulate did not get bad, but when those people did not worship correctly, worshiped out of fear or whatever, this part of the brain started kicking up and all the stress chemistry started kicking in. And all these bad things started happening. And I said, wow, science is proving that worship creates the connections as well as change our chemistry physically. So, you know, maybe this creating me a new brain, a new mind, maybe it has something. Maybe it's something this is important that we can learn about today. But also, what about worship that's not right? What about people that don't worship the true God? What about people that fear God or worship God out of guilt? We now have scientific proof that that damages our bodies and triggers this stress cascade that can actually hurt us. So this new brain that David was talking about had something to do with his anterior cingulate and the prefrontal cortex. And I'm hoping that more research will be done on this, but can you imagine what the PET scan of someone like Enoch might look like, who walked with God? Can you imagine his stress level and stress chemistry? Well, no wonder he didn't have any disease. He's creating all these healthy chemistries going on. Can you imagine what the anterior cingulate of Christ looked like? Well, wouldn't it be so interesting if we took 100 people and studied the way we worshiped and did CAT scans on them and said, well, listen, how are you worshiping? And how do you think about God? What is your framework of worship? And then you study with another group that worshiped this way, and you could study their anterior cingulate and their PET scans, and you could tell them, you know, you guys aren't quite worshiping correctly, and because of this, it's created a lot of negative chemistry. And maybe if we do this and this and do the PET scan, maybe this worship is the best worship for you. Or how about those that are doing right? Say, listen, you've worshiped this way this year, and your brain gradually gets bigger, and you can marry these neurochemicals. Wouldn't that just be so fascinating to see if you were actually doing it right? Well, we have now have that technology. We now can do that thing. Well, I just wanted to introduce you, and it's much more complicated than this, but I don't want to leave you hanging here. You know, I want a new heart, a new mind. I also want to introduce this to patients, introduce this to people that need healing. Well, how does David do this? What is the first step? Well, the first step is to ask for the gift. We have to ask and we have to realize it's a gift. It's nothing we can do in and of ourselves. It's a gift that comes from God. And as I was studying this, I went to this text in Matthew 11:28, if I can get there, going the wrong direction again. Matthew 11:28. It says, come unto me. What does that mean? Worship me. Come unto me. Be with me. Have a relationship with this ultimate physician. In David's case, it wasn't just about the food. It was about the worship. Come unto me, all you who would labor and are heavy laden. That's all of us in the big boat that's under stress. We're under stress because of this world, and we've seen that this amygdala is turned on. All you that are heavy and heavy laden, this amygdala is making a bunch of bad chemistry. Come unto me, worship me, and I will give you rest. I will turn off this bad stress chemistry. I will help the front of your brain start to grow. I will help you out. Come unto me, worship me. This is a very valuable treatment for us. Better treatment than a pill. Better treatment than procedures for us. So when we think about it, when we worship Him, we now have scientific proof that our body's changing. I have another thing to add, another biblical treatment, more biblical technology to help people change. It's always been about worship. Think about it. The Garden of Eden. We had, who do you worship? The true God or you worship the serpent? Daniel's time. Do you worship the true God or do you worship an image in the field? And what happens to your brain when you worship the true God? And you eat right. The brain gets better. In Christ's time, did they worship the true God or did they worship their institutions? And nowadays, it's still always about worship. It's about worship. Do we worship ourselves? Do we worship being too busy in our active lives? Do we worship football or sports? Do we worship our things? Do we worship our clothes? Do we worship our time? Do we worship ourselves? It's always been about worship. Now follow me for a second. The brain was made to worship God. And remember, our definition of stress was getting back to the way we were originally designed. The brain was made to worship God. When the brain is worshiping anything else, guess what happens? The stress chemistry is activated. The adrenaline, the cortisol, all the bad stuff starts to happen to us. The brain was made to worship God. And we become like that we worship. A bride was shopping for her wedding dress. This bride was going to make her own wedding dress because she was going to get married soon. And she went from store to store, and she was looking not for the prettiest material or the softest material, but she was actually looking for the noisiest material that she could find. And she went from store to store, bolt to bolt, looking for material. And she really wanted to find something that was just noisy. The salesperson came up to her and said, "Listen, this makes no sense. I've never, ever had a bride that wants the just noisiest, ugliest, or whatever. I've never had the one that wants the noisiest. What's going on here?" And she says, "My fiance is blind, and he's never, ever seen me before. And when I walk down that aisle, I want him to hear me. I want him to know when I've arrived at the altar." Wow. There are times in my life, there are times in your lives that God wants to get noisy with us, to let us know that he's here. He might not be in a concert hall. He might be playing something, and we might not even know what he looks like sometimes because we have all these preconceived notions. We might just find his voice in our everyday activities as we look for him and he looks for us. I hope today, as we worship together, that this is one of those days for you. He wants to talk to you right now. And the voice may not be a Mount Sinai voice or a blinding light on the way to Damascus. It might just be a small voice tugging at your heart. Or should I say anterior cingulate? Is the greatest healer, the ultimate physician, the one that we should look for answers to all life's questions, is he playing heart-changing music for us to hear? Or am I too busy with life to listen? Am I too busy with preconceived notions? Am I too busy to take the time to find truth and live the life we were designed to live? Well, every one of us today needs a treatment for life stress. We need a treatment that will prevent disease. We need a treatment, something that will heal us. It might not heal us right away. It might heal us as we make changes, little bits at a time, but for sure it'll heal us in the end. Well, worship and this relationship is now a scientifically proven treatment. The chemistry and structural changes are more valuable than I can relate. This relationship, this chemistry, also gives us the power to make changes, these new neural connections. These might be not everything at once. It might be one thing done at a time, slow but sure. We might have to come back to the doctor's office quite a bit. Every day we should come back to that and get a new prescription. But you know what? This is truly treatment for our lives. This is biblical technology. Once again, we have the science to prove that God's word is true. Years ago, they had preconceived notions about the center of reasoning. Even Solomon had it. Hippocrates had it. I had preconceived notions on what healing should look like, what healing should really be. And today, like David, do you want God to create in you a new heart, a new mind, an actual structural and chemical change now proven by cutting-edge research? Well, right now I want to tell you, you are in the right place. This is the place to worship. This is the place to change your chemistry. This is the place to listen to that voice. This place is where healing occurs. Create in me a new heart. Ask. Accept the gift. Come unto Him. Worship Him. However that might look in your life. And He will be faithful to heal.